Welcome to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. Women have lost the constitutional right to bodily autonomy. On today's show, we talk about what's next. On June 24th, 2022, the U.S. Supreme Court overturned the constitutional right of women's bodily autonomy and the right to an abortion as enshrined in the 1973 decision Roe v. Wade. This is the first time in U.S. history that the Supreme Court has removed a personal constitutional right recognized by a previous court. The post-Roe legal, political, and social world is chaotic as women seek to preserve their reproductive autonomy in light of this drastic shift in legal protections. On today's show, we will explore the post-Roe world with an emphasis on future legal struggles and the social challenge of ensuring reproductive health and equality. Our panel today is Aziza Ahmed, professor of law at the Boston University School of Law. She's the author of The Future of Facts, The Politics of Public Health and Medicine in Abortion Law, Informed Decision-Making in Abortion, Crisis Pregnancy Centers, Informed Consent, and the First Amendment, and Medical Evidence and Expertise in Abortion Jurisprudence. Greer Donnelly is Associate Professor of Law at the University of Pittsburgh's Law School. She's the author of Medication Abortion Exceptionalism and co-author of Abortion, Pregnancy Law, and Subjective Fetal Personhood with Jill Weber-Lenz and The New Abortion Battleground with David S. Cohen and Rachel Rebuchet. Carrie Franklin is Professor of Law at UCLA and the Faculty Director of UCLA Center on Reproductive Health, Law, and Policy. She's the author of Roe as We Know It, Whole Women's Health versus Hellerstedt and What It Means to Protect Women, and Living Textualism. And Carol Jaffe, professor in the Department of Obstetrics, Gynecology, and Reproductive Sciences at the University of California, San Francisco. She is the author of Doctors of Conscience, The Struggle to Provide Abortion Before and After Roe v. Wade, Dispatches from the Abortion Wars, The Costs of Fanaticism to Doctors, Patients, and the Rest of Us, and the co-author of Obstacle Course, The Everyday Struggle to Get an Abortion in America with David S. Cohen. Thank you all very much for joining us. Greer Donnelly, let's start with you. What exactly was decided in this Dobbs decision overturning Roe v. Wade? And I'm going to also ask you to fact check me. Is this actually the first time that a constitutional personal right protection recognized by a previous court has been overturned by a later court?
Yeah, so the Supreme Court in Dobbs overturned a few previous cases that people probably know about, Roe versus Wade and Planned Parenthood versus Casey. Those were foundational cases which held that there is a constitutional right to abortion that is protected by the Due Process Clause in our Constitution. So in the Dobbs case, the Supreme Court used a historical analysis to examine what the rights were at the time of the ratification of the 14th Amendment to hold that there actually was no right to abortion within the Constitution. As far as I know, it is the only time where the Supreme Court has overturned a right that was protected, especially under the 14th Amendment.
And actually, Greer Donnelly, I'll follow this up. What was the justification the court gave for overturning this right?
Well, the court did a bunch of analyses within it. I mean, their primary legal analysis, again, relied on a history of what existed, what the fundamental rights were at the time of ratification. So, substantive due process is a legal doctrine which examines what rights exist in the Constitution that are not explicitly listed within them. Only a few very fundamental rights are included within substantive due process. And so the court decided to re-examine what substantive due process should mean and to only find that the rights are only fundamental and therefore protected by substantive due process if they existed at the time of ratification. And the court really went back in time at a time when many people would note that people of color, women, LGBT people lacked, kind of comprehensive rights to decide what rights were fundamental, concluding that there was no right to abortion. The court also did a stare decisis analysis. So, there might have been a reason to uphold the right to abortion, even if there was no historical precedent, just on the premise that we should uphold precedent for the sake of reliance interests and other reasons. The court concluded that there was no reason to uphold precedent here because they said that this was a unique reliance interest And that, you know, they criticized the past opinions and said that they created unworkability and therefore said that there was no reason to uphold the precedent.
And Carrie Franklin, part of what Gerard Donnelly is describing is kind of this originalism that's being discussed in the press. How much is this guided by originalism versus, I know you've written about textualism as well, and what's the relationship between those two approaches?
I think this decision falls under a broad umbrella that I would call originalism. And the basic theory of originalism is that you go back to the time at which the constitutional text that you're investigating was ratified, and you ask what the original public meaning of that text was at the time of ratification, on the theory that that's the understanding that went through all the processes that made it law. So an originalist would say, when you heard the term liberty or when you heard the term equal protection in 1868, when the 14th Amendment was enacted, what was the original public meaning? How did people understand those terms at the time? And if they didn't understand, say, abortion rights or LGBT rights to be protected 150 years ago, they are not protected today. I think there's a bit of a debate about whether this opinion counts as originalist, because Justice Alito didn't say he was adopting an originalist methodology. He said he was adopting a text and history methodology, which might be a little different. He's asking, is it deeply rooted in American history and tradition? He goes back to the 13th century, he goes to the 14th century, he's in the 19th century, he's in the 20th century. He's all over the place. I actually think he's not very clear about where he's resting his analysis. He is looking at, was this a right that has a long history of being protected under the 14th Amendment? He concludes, using history somewhat selectively, that it doesn't. I guess what I would say about both of these methodologies, originalism or this originalist-tinged history and tradition approach, is that, as Greer noted, they're both looking back into a past in which most people today didn't have a vote, didn't have a say, weren't represented. And it is not surprising that a lot of the rights we've taken for granted in the last 50 years after social movements and civil rights movements have increased our understanding of the terms liberty and equality are now going to be cut out by this court. I think one of the more controversial questions is that considered a feature or a bug of this approach. People can have different views on that question, but it certainly does that. It certainly diminishes the rights of groups whose liberty and equality claims come subsequent to the enactment of constitutional provisions.
And Aziza Ahmed, one of the interesting responses from the Dobbs ruling, the overturning of Roe, has been this emphasis on healthcare questions. The original decision by Harry Blackmun seemed to rest really on some form of healthcare provision, more so than necessarily rights or equality of women, et cetera. I know you've written quite a bit on the intersection between our understanding of health and law. Did the Dobbs decision reflect any of that understanding of abortion as a healthcare question?
That's a great question. Thank you so much. I think one of the things to note about Roe, as you mentioned, is that Blackmun, and this is a famous history, it's been written by Linda Greenhouse in her biography of Blackmun as one source. Blackmun was a lawyer for the Mayo Clinic, and he was very influenced by medical practitioners and really believed in the sort of authority of medical knowledge and medical expertise. And the Roe decision was full of this type of analysis, where he's basically saying that this is about physicians, this is about decisions that physicians make. He takes great care to think about what the American Medical Association has thought. He takes great care to sort of paint what's happening as a clinical problem between a physician and his patient. And I use his on purpose. That has all been part of what opened the decision up for attack, because that is not what we think of when we think of a sort of traditional legal analysis. People instead argued, feminists instead argued, Ruth Bader Ginsburg instead argued, we should have used a 14th Amendment analysis. They should have turned towards equal protection. They should have recognized that abortion was actually you know, harming women and impacting women's lives and ability to be full citizens and full economic actors. But the court didn't go that way. They instead went the way of substantive due process, as Greer mentioned, and they went the way of privacy. And it essentially set the stage for many different types of attacks. But you also asked about the healthcare question, which is, you know, does Dobbs take up any of these issues? And I think one of the odd things about reading Dobbs and one of the strange things about the way the court actually treats history is that the turn towards history and the turn towards the 18th century essentially allows for a complete erasure of the experience of women in seeking abortion from the beginning, you know, from the earliest points that we have history for. And we know that women were always seeking abortions, partly because there's all of this adverse lawmaking on abortion. You know, Justice Kavanaugh says, well, we're acting neutrally by turning the question back to the states, by making it a question of politics. That's a problem because we don't want a basic healthcare procedure to become politicized in the way that Justice Thomas is opening the door, or sorry, Justice Kavanaugh is opening the door for. But you know, when the dissent takes up Kavanaugh's claim that this is neutral, and when the dissent speaks up, they do put issues of women's health right on the table. They talk about the harmful effects that this is going to have on women. They talk about pregnancy complications. They talk about mental health consequences of carrying a pregnancy to term. You know, that's where you actually see that, you know, the court is concerned. It's in the dissent that you read that there are actual healthcare consequences here. There are actual consequences for women's health, but the majority ignores that entirely, which is, I think, what makes this decision so appalling and shocking, amongst other reasons, of course. But one of the reasons is that they just ignore the experience of real people altogether.
And so far, we've been talking about the legal analysis, but Carol Jaffe, when thinking about the impact, you know, of the debates, and you've written about the cost of fanaticism within the healthcare community, what kind of risk are we taking with the Dobbs decision and now this post-Roe world on just the provision of healthcare, reproductive health for women?
As my legal colleagues have already made clear, we are in an absolutely chaotic moment where people literally don't know what is legal, what is not legal. A number of abortion funds, which are absolutely crucial, helping pregnant people move from a ban state to a so-called surge state or a haven state. Some of these funds have actually shut down because Texas's law, for example, speaks of aiding prosecution available for aiding and abetting an abortion. Providers are very confused. I should say, speaking as someone who has studied the provider community for many years, this is an extraordinarily committed group. It's not just a job, it's a mission. So blue state providers absolutely want to help. Red state providers who can no longer provide abortions in red states want to go to the blue states and help. But it's just an extraordinary confusing environment. Among the many, many different problems presented by the Dobbs decision, what becomes of training? More than half of all OBGY residents are in red states. They need to be trained. I mean, even in places where abortion will be banned, there are theoretically, and we can talk more about it in practice, but there are theoretically exceptions to save the life of the pregnant woman. If the pregnant person lives in a state where no one knows how to do abortions, that's a very serious business. So to answer your question in one sentence, it's a very chaotic, disturbing, and very unclear situation.
Although to follow up quickly, Carol Jaffe, my understanding is this chaos that you're describing certainly has not emanated just from Dobbs. In a number of these red states that have been passing as many restrictions as the Supreme Court would allow them, there's just been a dearth of doctors, of healthcare providers who even want to learn and provide, in part for their own personal safety, and definitely the difficulties they would have professionally. This has a pretty long tradition, right? long history, I should say.
And there was a very long history of an abortion provider shortage. Actually, over the past several years, it's gotten much better. There has been very concerted efforts by the pro-choice medical community to do training. So the problem is no longer training. The problem is geographical distribution. And in many of the states in the South, some in the Midwest, it is very uncomfortable for a local OBGYN, even if he or she is committed to this practice, to provide abortion. So we have seen over the years, a lot of my Bay Area colleagues who are real doctors, unlike me, who's a sociologist, a lot of my Bay Area colleagues fly to Texas, or until it was shut down today, used to fly to Mississippi. So there were systems in place to assure coverage, even if it was not only by local doctors. Now, yes, it used to be very hard and challenging to provide abortion, but it wasn't, you were not risking jail time. And now, of course, you are. You're risking jail time. You are risking huge fines, loss of your medical license. So it's to answer your question, Doug, it's a notch above. The situation was always not great. Now it is horrible.
And you're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. We're discussing the post-Roe legal, social, medical world with Aziza Ahmed of Boston University, Guri Donnelly of the University of Pittsburgh, Carrie Franklin of UCLA, and Carol Jaffe of the University of California at San Francisco. And Guri Donnelly, the legal challenges just sort of began with Dobbs. I mean, even since the Dobbs decision, there have been quite a number of legal challenges, and the fragmentation of access to abortion on a state-to-state basis is really pronounced. What's been going on, since Dobbs, and do you have any sort of sense of the direction that we're going with respect to all the different state laws and all these different decisions, these court cases that are being filed?
Yeah, I mean, I think you used a word in the very beginning that is very applicable here. It is pure chaos. So not only are we seeing just radical changes in abortion law that are occurring at a moment's notice, states that have banned abortion, and then there's a court order, and now they're allowed to have abortion. And then there's all this back and forth within states. We're also seeing an anti-abortion movement that is extremely emboldened in this moment and willing to try radical new strategies. So across many different Republican states, you're seeing states that are introducing and considering laws that would try to chill people for traveling to get an abortion care out of state. We're seeing states that are considering a variety of laws that would really try to stop abortion pills from coming into their borders. On the other hand, you see blue states that are also passing a variety of laws. So states like Connecticut and New York and Delaware have passed laws trying to shield their providers. So all of a sudden, we're living in this world where every single state's laws are completely different and changing at a moment's notice. And it's just really hard to see now that like abortion has become an interstate issue where people are traveling across the country, how all of this is going to play out in the courts when we start seeing some of these novel legal issues appear there.
And to follow up, Guri Donnelly, you made a reference to abortion pills, the so-called, medicinal abortion or self-abortion, I think it sometimes gets described. And I know there have been some states, Louisiana comes to mind, that have at least debated bills that would prosecute anybody who receives these in the mail. My initial reaction was, don't we have Fourth Amendment protections? Can we rely on the Fourth Amendment to try to ensure that those kinds of searches and seizures are unconstitutional?
So I'm not a Fourth Amendment scholar. I'll let someone else answer that. But I will say that one other area of law that is super relevant in this context is FDA law, where I am an expert in. So medication abortion is a medication regimen that has been approved by the federal government, the FDA, in 2000. And for two decades, it has been extremely regulated by this federal agency. We're going to see in the coming months and years really intense conflicts between the federal government and states as states try to restrict these abortion pills. And the federal government says, wait a second, your jurisdiction is not abortion medication. That is ours, the FDA. We are the agency charged with regulating this product. And, you know, whether or not states are going to be able to pass these laws and then the enforcement, you know, effectively enforce them, given that mail comes in and out of state borders unchecked all the time, is another question. But certainly I would say people should be worried about states going after pregnant people who try to self-manage their abortions illegally within the state. There are serious legal risks, and you know, it's not that it's safe and effective, but there are legal risks.
And Aziza Ahmed, it seems then this question about medical expertise, again, in legal issues, Greer Donnelly, you know, highlighted this is really kind of this is an FDA issue. This is a medication issue. Is this a trend now where we're looking that states are starting to regulate what typically we would view as these just medical decisions that typically weren't regulated?
So yes, you're right. So basically abortion and medication abortion in particular is being now, states are basically experimenting with how to ban medication abortion. And as they experiment with how to ban medication abortion, they're bringing in prosecutors, they're bringing in investigators. They're going to try to essentially hold people accountable for taking a medication that they need to take, for having a procedure that they need to have, in some cases to save their life, at least to better their health, or maybe to help with their own financial situation, you know, but this is a medical procedure, and states are essentially trying to use whatever tools that they can. Conservative states are trying to use whatever tools that they can to essentially outlaw it. And they are certainly quickly moving into the domain of medical experts and medical expertise. And that's why I think we see so much pushback from organizations like the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecologists, why the American Medical Association has really changed its tune since the days of Roe on abortion. And I think, unfortunately, the conservative states are doing a good job because, as Carol mentioned, you know, providers are scared, funders are scared, people who are helping women access this medical procedure are afraid of being prosecuted under these new legal rules.
And Carol Jaffe, is this changing then, you know, the general provision, you know, of this healthcare? Because I mean, we actually have done previous shows where there seemed to be at least some suggestion that with the ability for self-abortion, particularly from this medicinal perspective, that maybe the overturning of Roe wasn't going to be as chaotic or as, you know, as destructive of women's rights, but others suggesting that's a little bit Pollyannish to think that somehow abortion is going to be able to be provided medicinally and we don't need to worry about having clinics any longer.
I go with the side that says it's somewhat Pollyannish. I mean, it is the case, and perhaps most of your listeners know this, but just in case, I mean, these pills that have been mentioned can be ordered off the internet. One of the major providers is a group based in Austria, actually. It's called Aid Access. The doctor does a video call with a potential patient. I mean, this group based in Vienna has for years provided medication abortion all over the globe. It's only recently that they started operations in the United States. And nobody in Austria is worried that they're going to be extradited to Texas. So that's a real advantage of that group. And there's other groups. I mean, there's a lot of creative strategies going on. For example, just this morning, I should say I share custody of a co-author with Greer. We are both very fortunate. David Cohen and I interviewed someone about the plan to have mobile clinics going to the borders of blue states, but near red states, and people could come and get them. So yes, I mean, these pills may, for some people, will actually work. One of the medication, it's a two drug regimen, but the second one is almost as effective. It's sold over the counter in Mexico. So some women near the Mexican border, cross over and get this drug. So for some women, it will work. But for other women, as people, as has been suggested, there will be detection and there will conceivably be arrests. I noticed that Greer needs to leave. So if you let me stop here and if you have another question.
I do have one more quick question for Greer Donnelly. I know that you've written about this new abortion battleground. It's been something that's been talked about quite a bit, since the Dobbs decision and the dissent. What do you see ultimately is the real key provisions of the new abortion battleground?
You know, I think our main contribution is to suggest that this argument that the majority proposes that, that Professor Ahmed mentioned that Justice Kavanaugh says in his concurrence that this will, return abortion to the states and it will all get simpler is just a complete fallacy, and that we are going to see all of the confusion and the interstate conflicts and federal state conflicts that are coming down the pike. But we also really wanted to highlight in our paper that states, pro-choice states and pro-choice federal government have a lot of tools in their at their disposal to expand abortion access, and that they should use them. You know, the anti-abortion movement has been creative and has been relentless for decades. And, they're at the moment where they're achieving a major victory. And I think we as a movement need to adopt some of that aggression and some of that urgency in this moment, because we are really at a crisis.
And then just real quick, I've heard this and some of the suggestions I've heard, some obvious ones, get rid of the filibuster and congressional legislation that would enshrine rights to an abortion, but some of the more creative ones about creating abortion clinics on indigenous on tribal lands, or I know Carol Jaffe suggesting the mobile clinics. Are those the sorts of things that you are suggesting, or is there anything that we really haven't been talking about much that you think could potentially be a creative way that the Biden administration might be able to protect these rights?
Yeah, so I think that we've been pushing a variety of ideas. One of them is the federal preemption. So we started talking about how the FDA's regulation of medication abortion might actually preempt state abortion bans, and the federal government could be involved in trying to, poke pretty large holes in state abortion bans by using preemption theories. We have talked a lot about federal lands, but have been very careful to avoid any discussion of native lands because, indigenous communities really struggle to access reproductive health care themselves. And, I don't think it's our job to suggest that these communities should come to our rescue when they didn't create this problem. But in terms of federal land, we do think that there is some really interesting and creative possibilities there. They have some risks, but they have some real benefits. And we certainly are hoping that the Biden administration will consider them.
And with that, unfortunately, we need to say goodbye to Greer Donnelly, but we will be back. And when we return, we're going to talk about what some of these other strategies might be in this post-Roe world and what this means for the legal and political social landscape. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. We are discussing the impact of the overturning of Roe v. Wade and what a post-Roe world would look like legally, politically, and socially in the United States. Our guests today are Aziza Ahmed, Professor of Law at Boston University School of Law, Carrie Franklin, Professor of Law at UCLA and the Faculty Director of UCLA's Center on Reproductive Health, Law, and Policy, and Carol Jaffe, Professor in the Department of Obstetrics, Gynecology, and Reproductive Sciences at the University of California, San Francisco. Carrie Franklin, I want to bring you in, on this question. And broadly, the anti-abortion movement has focused on women's health, physical health, reproductive health, also mental health as a justification, arguing that, in fact, the way I framed the question about this being about healthcare or about rights is mistaken, then in reality, the greatest protections, you know, for women are to try to outlaw abortion to try to protect their health. And I know you've written about the Hellerstedt decision that was specifically on that issue. So what is the nature of that argument and how is that proceeded, you know, legally and politically as we start thinking about post-war world and reproductive rights?
In the period of Roe and for some time after, the anti-abortion movement was very focused on fetuses, and they would, you know, have marches with pictures of bloody fetuses and portray women as killers. And they weren't getting very far with this strategy. It turns out a lot of Americans didn't like to think of pregnant women as murderers, didn't view them as killers, were uncomfortable with bloody fetal tissue being thrust in their faces and angry red-faced people screaming at them. And so they devised a strategy called Protect Them Both, a woman protective approach, where the argument shifted. It was focus grouped, it was focus tested, and the idea was it would be more popular approach to say, actually, we're protecting the fetus and the woman. Abortion is actually, although you thought it was reproductive rights and reproductive health care, it actually harms women. And so we're, by outlawing access to reproductive health care, we're saving the fetus, we're saving the women. They are a unit and we are for them both. That helped the anti-abortion movement advance because it was a more palatable message. And the movement constructed a number of pseudoscientific arguments, one being post-abortion syndrome, sort of fake syndrome, where women apparently suffer from abortions because they have grief that results from going through this procedure, because actually it turns out women are tricked into this. They don't really want to do it. Men and abortion industrialists force them into it. No woman naturally would want to have an abortion. This made its way into Justice Kennedy's opinion in the Carhart case. And so it really was quite successful. I do think there has been a lot of pushback from scientists, from the medical community, from evidence-based researchers saying this is not actually true. There's been a really important study called the Turnaway study, where they looked at women who are just on the brink, some of whom got abortions and some of whom were just after the deadline and didn't. And it turns out there are deleterious consequences when you're not able to choose. And I would also point out that 75% of women in this country and people in this country who are getting abortions are poor and low income. And most already have children, and most are making decisions based on their family's well-being and their own personal well-being and their reproductive health care in general. On the healthcare picture, I just think it is absolutely not true that the idea that shutting down reproductive rights and shutting down all these clinics, which by the way, provide a whole range of care to people, will in any way enhance women's health. We know that it will not. We know that it is dangerous for teenagers to go through pregnancy. We know it is dangerous for a wide range of women, physically, emotionally, mentally, for the well-being of their families. We're seeing in the dissent in that case, in the reproductive justice movement, people pushing back. But I do think that both sides are now arguing health, and that has enabled the anti-abortion forces to make some real headway in the last couple of decades.
Aziza Ahmed, when thinking about these debates or these conversations about health, the so-called crisis pregnancy centers, you know, come to mind. I know you've written about the crisis pregnancy centers. How much is this focused on, you know, questions of health? And I know that certainly there have been claims made at these crisis pregnancy centers that just haven't reflected the science.
You know, just for your listeners, in case they don't know, crisis pregnancy centers are centers. And the reason I'm explaining this is because I'm always surprised how many people don't know about crisis pregnancy centers. But they're centers that essentially, for the most part, fraud women who are trying to seek abortion services. So they'll set up a clinic very near to a legitimate abortion clinic, or they'll set up a set up a service that, and they said the services inside look like they're being essentially administered by healthcare providers. They use sonogram machines. They make everything look like a healthcare clinic, but actually they're designed to dissuade women from accessing abortions. They're dangerous. They're fraudulent. They often explicitly lie to women about the how far along she is in her pregnancy. They lie to people who are pregnant about how far along they are in their pregnancy. They provide incorrect information about the costs and consequences of abortion. And they have evaded regulation. I think that's what's so shocking about their existence. Even the state of California, which tried to regulate crisis pregnancy centers, faced a legal challenge that went to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court held essentially on First Amendment grounds that, you know, you can't regulate crisis pregnancy centers in the way that California wanted to, which was essentially to force them to give disclosures to people who are accessing the services that they weren't actually providing medical services and they weren't necessarily licensed facilities. And so in the mix of people trying to get abortion services, as Carrie described, as people are trying to seek for help, they're turning to whatever services they can find, and crisis pregnancy centers are there. And there are way more crisis pregnancy centers than there are abortion clinics. And so, you know, you're more likely to stumble upon a crisis pregnancy center in your Google search, or if you're just walking down the street. Or even, you know, we've heard of instances where people think they're going to the clinic where they had the appointment and they accidentally go to the crisis pregnancy center because they look so similar. I think in the realm of medication abortion, we're going to see this misinformation proliferate because people are going to be relying on the internet even more. And if we've learned anything from the run-up to Trump's victory, presidential victory, it's that there is rampant false information on the internet and circulating through the media and through WhatsApp. And the COVID crisis has emphasized this even more. I think we're in uncharted and new territory here where there's going to be new forms of deception, and women are people are going to be navigating healthcare in an even more difficult circumstance than they have been.
Absolutely. And Carol Jaffe had a response to about the crisis pregnancy centers as well.
One thing I'd like to add to Aziza's excellent, sobering account is that these crisis pregnancy centers get millions of public funding. In Texas, for example, a few years ago, the public family planning program was cut way, way back, and millions were given to these crisis pregnancy centers. So if you live in a red state, that is what you are, where your tax dollars are going. Very often, I mean, Aziza mentioned that people end up sometimes in the wrong place. And that's because one of the strategies of the crisis pregnancy center movement has been to locate their facility as close as possible, in many cases, literally next door to an authentic abortion clinic. So it is a serious problem. And as Aziza says, it will only get more serious as people scramble to find options.
And Carrie Franklin, I'd like to note the irony then that so many of our tax dollars apparently are going to these crisis pregnancy centers, but thanks to the so-called Hyde Amendments, none of them can go for provision of abortion or anything even somewhat related to the provision of abortion. So I guess my question is, how much of a federal response to this is reliant on overturning the Hyde Amendment?
I think overturning the Hyde Amendment would have a major impact. I don't think Congress is going to overturn the Hyde Amendment tomorrow, but that doesn't mean there's nothing the federal government can do. So I just want to echo some of what's been said earlier. I think one of the areas that's really important for the federal government to act has to do with medication abortion. The FDA's handling of medication abortion has been highly politicized. Historically, the FDA has regulated medication abortion in a category with drugs that are much, much more dangerous, put restrictions on those drugs that aren't merited by the science of those drugs, but by the politics of some folks in the country disliking them. So one thing the FDA could do is take a more science-based approach, which after all is its mission, and say, a couple of things. One, medication abortion is safe beyond the 10 weeks that the FDA currently has set the safety limitations, so they could increase that. I think more importantly, they could say that the FDA's determination that these drugs are safe and efficacious, which is followed years, decades of studies, evidence showing that these are safe and effective medication, the FDA has said that, they could say that preempts state law regulation of these drugs. So numerous states have put on additional restrictions on these drugs on the theory that they're unsafe, that they create, and there's not science backing up. And the Attorney General, Merrick Garland, actually said that he's interested in exploring the idea of preemption of all of those medical restrictions that states, through no evidence-based reasons, have placed on medication abortion, and that federal law may preempt that. It may be that federal law preempts all restrictions, state restrictions on medication abortion, on the theory that the FDA has the power to determine what medications are safe and effective and should be available in a national market. That's why corporations spend tens of millions of dollars going through the FDA approval process so that they get access to the national market. And they have done that here. And there's an argument that because federal law is supreme over state law, that's the bedrock constitutional principle, that the federal FDA's determination that these pills are safe should preempt state attempts to ban them. That would be the most aggressive move that the federal government could take. We'll have to see whether the FDA and the Biden administration choose to do that. There are also, I'll just end by saying, there are questions about what you can pay for. The Hyde Amendment means you can't use federal funds for abortion spending through Medicaid and other programs, but it's not clear what if the federal government paid for people's travel. So they're not paying for the abortions or the medical care, but they're paying for travel for people in anti-abortion states to reproductive freedom states. That's arguably allowed and something that Congress could do. There are a number of things short of overturning Hyde that the administration and Congress could currently do. And perhaps we will see in the coming months whether they decide to step up to the plate there.
You're listening to Scholar Circle. ScholarCircle.org. We are discussing the post-Roe legal, political, social world in the United States and reproductive freedoms with Carrie Franklin of UCLA, Aziza Ahmed of Boston University, and Carol Jaffe of the University of California, San Francisco. Carrie Franklin, I'm trying to decide who I'm going to ask this of, because since you had mentioned about sort of state versus federal, the elephant in the room was highlighted by Mike Pence, when they were calling for a federal ban on abortion as a result of the overturning of Dobbs. All of these conversations we've been having about ways to ensure reproductive freedom is presuming that there's not a federal law banning abortion. Are we really at that knife's edge where if there is a unified Republican government, you know, both houses of Congress controlled by Republicans and a Republican president, which could happen in 2024, that we could actually see a federal ban on abortion and making all these strategies irrelevant?
Theoretically, yes. You could have Congress pass a law banning abortion. At that point, there would be a constitutional challenge at the Supreme Court. You know, this would be the same court that decided Dobbs, deciding whether that law was constitutional. I think there are plenty of justices in the majority of Dobbs that would have no problem with Congress acting in that way. There may be a question of, you know, there may be some justices in the middle who find it problematic, but I don't know what to say. Yes, Congress could act in either way. Congress could pass a law saying abortion will be legal throughout the United States. Congress could pass a law saying abortion will not be legal throughout the United States. We have a very active Supreme Court. This would probably get up to them, and it would ultimately be up to them whether such laws would exist. But I guess I would say, if you care about these issues, the midterm elections are coming up. And I know there's a little bit of frustration that people are feeling about just being told to vote, but I'm going to tell you to vote because ultimately, I do think that voting is the best way to get ourselves out of this horrible predicament. And I will say that the majority of Americans believe that wanted Roe to remain on the books believe that at least in some circumstances, women and people capable of pregnancy should have the right to make these decisions for themselves. This is a majoritarian position, and hopefully we can keep our democracy functioning and have legislators respond to the will of the people. But this will depend ultimately on voting and protecting the processes of democracy. So work for reproductive rights and work for voting rights.
Absolutely. And that's certainly the recognition that not only the need to vote, that this is not voting versus something else, it's voting plus other actions, but the concerns that we have about election security and gerrymandering and all of the other issues make this a particularly, you know, a huge challenge. Now, Carol Chaffee, I know you've written about the debates, the discourses, you know, some of the, you know, conversations pre and post Roe. I mean, one thing that's certain is we're not going back to 1973, 1972. There's been a lot that's happened since then. But what is the history of the debates about the legalization of abortion and reproductive freedom? What does that suggest about what the future debates are going to look like?
Let me answer your question this way. I mean, it's a huge, important question, and it would take several hours to talk about it. But let me answer it this way. Before Roe, starting, I mean, 1870, by 1873, all states had criminalized abortion. It was a campaign then led by the AMA, and as one of our speakers mentioned, the AMA has completely turned around. But in the 19th century, the AMA was pushing for criminalization, not so much on moral or religious grounds at all. It was really a professionalization project. The AMA, which was newly founded, wanted to assert control over spheres of medicine, including obstetrics, and drive out other competitors, such as midwives and so forth. So what we had then was a, quote, century of criminalization. We had a lot of illegal abortion. Some estimates put it as high as 1.2 million, which I should point out is more than the most recent data we have. I mean, even before Dobbs, the most recent data from the Guttmacher Institute, which is the most reliable research group, put the number of American abortions about 850,000. So there was a lot of illegal abortion, and a lot of it, not all of it, but a lot of it was very unsafe. I mean, women died, there's no question, and many, many more were injured. And of course, those providing illegal abortions were doing something by definition against the law, but there was very little, relatively speaking, legal surveillance. We did not have an anti-abortion movement of the kind that, you know, we've heard our colleagues here describe. So there was a few providers went to jail, not for very long, a couple of years. So before Roe, a lot of injury, not that much legal surveillance. Fast forward to now, it's a mirror image. We're going to have some, but we're going to have much less injury, which is wonderful. The pills that we've been talking about are very safe and effective. And even if not entirely effective, they're very safe. It's very different than the coat hangers that we've heard about. And I should say, by the way, that these coat hangers were not just a metaphor. I have interviewed doctors who've told me they've had to remove coat hangers from a woman's vagina. So we're gonna have, it's gonna be much safer, but we're gonna have a lot more legal surveillance. And I fear that both people seeking abortions and those that help them will be arrested. And not just get a sentence of 1 or 2 years. I mean, we've seen, maybe some of my colleagues on this panel, maybe Carrie or Aziza can tell me if I'm correct. It seems to me that Louisiana said something about life imprisonment for doctors. I'm not sure that's correct, and I hope they will correct me. I know Texas talks about 10 years in jail.
Actually, Aziza, I'll follow this up then with you, because I know also there's been this conversation about who might get charged if it's a criminal offense. The traditional argument that we've seen coming out of the anti-abortion movement has been, well, we'll charge the doctors. But we're actually increasingly at least seeing this may be fringy arguments, but we're hearing them, that women could be charged, you know, with this as well. So is this just blather on the part of legislators, or this seems pretty serious to me?
Yeah, the claim that politicians don't want to prosecute people who are pregnant, women who are pregnant, I think it's just, I don't want to say they're lying. I'm sure there are some people who genuinely don't want to, but women and people who are pregnant are going to be prosecuted. You know, we already have a case in Texas where because of her miscarriage, a woman was essentially charged, but the charges were dropped, as I understand it. We have a long history in this country of prosecuting women for their behavior during pregnancy, especially drug use during pregnancy. And this really ramped up in the 1980s around the war on drugs, and it ramped up again in the opioid crisis. And, you know, really, I think what's another big dimension of this that I think is going to open the door to prosecuting patients is that it's going to essentially fall on physicians to determine whether or not a person used medication abortion or not. And for licensing reasons, for what they feel like are requirements to report criminal activity, they might actually sort of participate in saying, you know, oh, we think this person might have tried to end her pregnancy. And I think we're going to see a sort of cascading effect where people are essentially being held responsible for their behaviors. And in that sense, all pregnancies will become somewhat suspect.
And Carrie Franklin, you wanted to respond as well.
Yeah, I just want to follow that up. I do think that women and people capable of pregnancy are in legal jeopardy, and they're also in real medical jeopardy, not just seeking people seeking abortions, although obviously them, but a lot of the drugs that are used in obstetric care and gynecological care overlap with the drugs that are used in abortion care. We're already hearing reports of people unable to fill lupus prescriptions, rheumatoid arthritis prescriptions, miscarriage treatment would use the same drugs as the abortion protocol, and all of the IUD insertion. There are just so many overlapping forms of obstetric and gynecological care that rely on similar procedures or similar drugs. There are people having trouble filling prescriptions. There are doctors who are not performing the safest procedures because they're scared of prosecution, because this is all so overlapping. I really think it's important for people to understand that everybody is now implicated and potentially in danger if they can become pregnant by and may not get the care that they need. And it's a very frightening thing that politics has intruded so far into the care of pregnant people in this country that people will die, people will suffer, people, those seeking abortions and those not seeking abortions. And we have gone way off the rails that we are treating patients this way through prosecution and through inferior medical care. It is not a good time. And I think we need to band together and make people aware of this and see how we can get our way out of it.
And this is Ahmed, and I think at the core of all of this, many ways this has been framed, you know, Blackmun framed Roe v. Wade on healthcare, you know, provision. Ruth Bader Ginsburg, you know, critiqued that by saying it really should have been about women's equality. And though we have the possibility of, you know, if we're able to recover, you know, this right, you know, guarantee and recover this right, possibly building it on what I would consider to be a firmer foundation of women's equality, but it's at the core, it's an equality and healthcare foundation here. So I guess the question then is there a possibility that out of this chaos and potential disaster, we could actually have a firmer foundation for reproductive freedom?
Yes, I think so. I think that's what we should all be hoping for, you know, is that out of this, out of these ashes, essentially, of reproductive freedom and autonomy, will come a better set of legal rules that will protect us. The reason you probably hear hesitation in my voice is because I deeply believe that legal institutions are made up of people. And, you know, part of what makes this a long game and a long strategy and a long process is that it's going to mean that progressives have to actively think about federal court nominations. We have to make the institutions the way that we want them. You know, the FDA should be populated with people who are committed to, as Carrie said, science, but also committed to making sure that people have access to the healthcare that they need, you know, beyond simply a sort of formal scientific frame. They should have the right politics, essentially, is what I believe. And so, yeah, I hope that we will emerge out of this with stronger institutions, with stronger laws, with a better understanding of how to actually ensure that people are getting the healthcare that they need and the reproductive health services that they need. I think what is sad and depressing and predictable and horrifying about our current situation, though, is that getting there is going to mean that people die, that people's lives are ruined, as Carrie said, that people can't get the medication that they want. There's going to be so much, so many terrible things that people experience as we try to find our way back to a place where we can actually respect people's healthcare needs.
And with that, the hope for some degree of optimism, but make no mistake, the chaos, the threat, the politicization of healthcare and the threat to women's health, threat to women's equality, threat to, you know, women's livelihoods, et cetera, is real. And so I'll end with not just the importance of the conversation, but also a call for action that I think we all take from this, that we all need to fight. So our panel has been Aziza Ahmed, professor of law at Boston University School of Law. She is the author of The Future of Facts, The Politics of Public Health and Medicine and Abortion Law, Informed Decision-Making in Abortion, Crisis Pregnancy Centers, Informed Consent in the First Amendment, and Medical Evidence and Expertise in Abortion Jurisprudence. Greer Donnelly, Associate Professor of Law at the University of Pittsburgh Law School. She's the author of Medication Abortion Exceptionalism and co-author of Abortion, Pregnancy Loss, and Subjective Fetal Personhood with Jill Weber-Lenz, and The New Abortion Battleground with David S. Cohen and Rachel Ripochet. Carrie Franklin, professor of law at UCLA and the faculty director of UCLA's Center on Reproductive Health, Law, and Policy. She is the author of Roe as We Know It, Whole Women's Health versus Hellerstedt and What It Means to Protect Women, and Living Textualism. And Carol Jaffe, professor in the Department of Obstetrics, Gynecology, and Reproductive Sciences at the University of California, San Francisco. She is the author of Doctors of Conscience, The Struggle to Provide Abortion Before and After Roe v. Wade, Dispatches from the Abortion Wars, The Cost of Fanaticism to Doctors, Patients, and the Rest of Us, and the co-author of Obstacle Course, The Everyday Struggle to Get an Abortion in America with David S. Cohen. Thank you all very much for joining us. I'd like to give a special thanks to the Scholar Circle team, Maria Armudian, host and anchor, Ankine Agassian and Melissa Chiprin, managing producers, Sud Dongri, webmaster and production assistant. All Scholar Circle shows are archived on scholarcircle.org. You can find our podcast on Apple and Google Podcasts and iTunes. Please follow us on @ScholarCircle Twitter account, and please join our Facebook page. On behalf of the Scholar Circle team, I am Doug Becker. Thank you for listening.